the one of the last standing, objective, brilliant journalists left in the UK today, Tony Gosling, presenter of the politics show on BCFM, thisweek.org.uk, former BBC journalist, as honest as the day is long. Love having him on. Just before we say hello to him, it is being reported by the BBC that the Queen has agreed a period of transition in which the Duke and Duchess of Sussex will spend time in Canada and the UK. The Queen is entirely supportive, that's a quote, of their desire for a new role, but she would have preferred them to remain full-time working royals. More work to be done, says the Queen, but she expects final decisions to be made in the coming days. Tony Gosling meant every word of that, by the way. Welcome back to the programme. Good to have you, my friend. Should we expect something nasty to happen to Harry and Meghan in the next 12 to 18 months? I don't say that for giggles and all the rest of it. What do you make of this story? I was dismissing this as a nonsense, but I think it's more serious than I was giving it credit for. What do you think?
Well, it definitely is more serious, I think, Richie. I'm just taking a step back from the whole situation with Meghan and Harry and the royals. I would suggest that Harry is a bit of a free spirit. He's not been under so much pressure as William to be part of the family, you know, that's like the royal mafia. And I would suggest that Meghan is a deliberate attempt to control that rebel spirit within Harry. I mean, looking at her face, just literally the body language during the wedding, she didn't look to me as if she had any love for Harry. She looked to me like a gold digger, somebody who's just in there to make something of the situation. It could be Harry's vulnerable, but the most important thing is that she has slowly but surely shown herself to be an absolutely reprehensible character. And also she's been playing the race card as well, saying, I mean, for example, we got one of the best radio presenters in the world, certainly in the English language, Danny Baker, somebody that worked at Great London Radio when I was there years ago, fantastic guy.
Yeah.
He is sacked from the BBC for what is not a racist post, but she apparently decided that this was racism and she wanted this guy punished. Anyway, so
how do we know that, Tony? How do we know that Meghan Markle had anything to do with Danny Baker's dismissal?
Well, because I would assume that there was something to do, that she would have had something to do with that. The BBC would not have made such an important decision without consulting with the royals. Remember, it's just a royal charter the BBC is convened under, and there's a very close relationship between the royal family and the BBC. There always has been. So the idea because the thing is, they have to do that sort of thing, because if the BBC were to sack the guy, and she was to then come out and say, I think this is wrong, this would leave the BBC with egg on their face. So they have to have these back channels. And of course you can't prove these things. I'm just trying to use a little bit of educated guesswork and see the sort of things that have happened in the past. Look at the relationship between the royal family and the BBC.
Yeah.
And it's 99% back channels, and only 1% is what we actually, as the public, get to see, or even as journalists get to see. So that's why I think, she has been also part of creating this massive, lots of publicity around herself and some kind of rift. But the most important thing is to see what's happened with her and her family and her friends, because she's cut all of them off, really. There's a few of her friends left who are supportive of her come what may. But particularly the whole thing with her father and the letter that she sent to her father. And then she misrepresented that letter through her and her friends in the press, saying various things that she didn't say in the letter, and really forced her father to hand the letter over to the Daily Mail so that that he could show, look, well, actually, what she said in this letter is completely opposite of what she's been saying. But anyway, so I'm not a great fan of Piers Morgan, but I agree with him. She's a splitter. She's in there to create rifts and splits, and she's done that with her friends, with her family, with Prince William, it seems. And basically she's been forcing Harry to choose between her and her friends, family, royals, and William too. So I would suggest you've got a bit of a free spirit with Harry. What we've got with her is someone who's been deliberately sent in to him in order to create as much rift as possible.
Let's talk about, hang on a second. Let's talk in a second about who might have sent in this woman. Hold that thought, because I want to play a 40-second clip. It's only 40 seconds. Now, I know you will have heard this clip, but I want to get your reaction to it. This is a clip of Prince Harry on an ITV documentary last October, where he said, I'm guessing you'll know what you're going to hear. It's only 40 seconds long. Have a listen to this, because my listeners tell me that I undersell this. I think this is Much Ado About Nothing, but my listeners tell me that this is Harry basically coming clean and saying, I know more about my family than you think. Have a listen, T. It's only 40 seconds, and then you can take over again. Here's the clip from ITV.
You know, my mum clearly taught me a certain set of values, of which I will always try and uphold, despite the role and the job that sometimes that entails, if you know what I mean. But I think I will always protect my family, and now I have a family to protect. So everything that she went through and what happened to her is incredibly raw every single day, and that's not me being paranoid, that's just me not wanting a repeat of the past. And if anybody else knew what I knew, be it a father, be it a husband, be it anyone, you'd probably be doing exactly what I'm doing as well.
What did he mean by that, Tony?
Well, I think he's trying to make comparisons between his own situation with his family and the press and Diana in the press. And I don't honestly think that that's comparable. I can't see it, personally. I don't think Meghan Markle is Princess Diana or has any of the same sort of characteristics as her at all. That's why I think Meghan seems to me to be somebody who's been deliberately targeting Harry, you know, not only just to make money, but also to make sure that to isolate him, I suppose. And of course, the best way to isolate Harry is to have somebody who's causing all sorts of trouble with others of his relations very close in. But the other thing I would say is that Harry, I would suggest, he's obviously very troubled by the secrecy that is expected of him in the royal family. And I think that's maybe one of the main reasons that was almost inevitable that this was going to happen at some time. And I don't think Meghan is really helping.
You don't believe so?
Making it worse.
Tony Gosling is our guest, by the way. A number of tweets have come in suggesting that Tony is only speculating that Markle did for Danny Baker. He is speculating, but to be fair to Tony, he's a BBC journalist. He was, and he understands the back channels that exist between the monarchy and the BBC, so he's based it on his own understanding of that. A number of tweeters, for want of a better word, are saying that's only speculation. Let me ask you this. So you don't think there's any case to be made that when he said, if people knew what I knew. You see, I agreed with you. I took it that he just meant things were very difficult for my mother. But there are people saying that because he's moved away, he's gone with Markle. It takes two to tango. It's not just Markle getting her hooks into him. He wanted an escape because he holds his family responsible for the death of his mother. That this is some sort of Hamlet thing. And again, I don't say that for a laugh here. He might believe, Tony, that his family were implicitly involved in his mother's demise. He might do.
Yes, I think he might. And I have no problem with that at all. I just think that the whole situation with Meghan is likely to to steer that in specific directions and possibly further isolate Harry. I feel really quite sorry for the guy. You know, the idea of him sitting in the family's mafia headquarters at Sandringham, being surrounded by the royals on, you know, behind him, in front of him, to the left and to the right. You know, it's almost as if the sword of Damocles is hanging over his head.
Yeah.
You
loved
better,
Diana,
think,
Tony, didn't you? Sorry to interrupt you again, my friend. I don't like interrupting you. You were a big fan. I mean, everybody I know, in the independent media, the journalists I respect, they really loved Diana. They believed that Diana was genuine, that she had a heart the size of England, and that these charitable things she was doing were genuine. And I think you would go along with that, would you? You believe that this was a special woman.
Most definitely. And I would also recommend to your listeners the book, The Princess Diana Assassination, The Paris-London Connection, by the late John Morgan, who I interviewed several times before he died. I'm not sure if you did. But, I mean, this really does make it absolutely clear that a guy called Sherard Cowper-Coles was brought over to Paris a few weeks before Diana's death and took over the MI6 station in Paris, and was basically the ringleader of what was a murder, an assassination of Diana. I mean, there was nothing was left to chance. After the accident happened and she was still alive, she was put into the ambulance and murdered on the way to the hospital. In fact, they hadn't killed her by the time they got to the hospital, so the ambulance had to stop. I think it was something like a few hundred yards away from the Paris St. Peter Hospital, and she was killed right there before she was brought into the hospital in the ambulance. So
imagine he knows that, Tony. Imagine living with that. Imagine he knows that. Listen, I want to read you another tweet. We've got loads of time, as you well know. Tony Gosling is our guest. Francis Leader, who's an activist and a campaigner and a regular guest on here, big fan of yours, Francis, but she says, oh, come on, Tony, don't you know how much Meghan was doing for good causes before she met Harry? It is wrong to call her a gold digger. She has her own. That just indicates that you have swallowed the fake news media yourself, T, and not researched a woman's past at all.
Listen, I don't follow any media. I'm just making my own conclusions from what I see, and I don't see her as some sort of champion hero. In fact, she's run out on Harry right now, hasn't she? She's left him isolated. Maybe if she had a bit of integrity, she should be in with Harry, standing right next to him whilst the royals are grilling him, because he's been isolated today.
He's stuck there on his own today. Before we move on to talk about Iran, and I love the work you've done on Martin Borman, by the way, the artist. Yeah. We'll talk about that as well. Tony Gosling, BCFM, I mean it, one of the last standing journalists in the United Kingdom. If you don't believe me, listen to Gilad Atzmon, who'll tell you the same thing. Very few guys like Tony Gosling writing and broadcasting in the UK today. Let's then, before we move on, I want to just stay with this. Imagine that chap. If you can leave to one side the privileged upbringing, if you can leave to one side the money, the entitlement, the wealth, all of that, imagine living, as you said, you described it as a mafia. Imagine being there and believing in your heart of hearts that institution, maybe your grandfather, were responsible for the death of your mother. That'd be enough to drive anybody insane, wouldn't it?
Well, no, not necessarily. I think you might just become rather embittered. And it's quite feasible that the main substance of this rift between Harry and the royals is this inability to address the murder of his mother. I mean, remember, you go back to medieval times and things like the princes in the towers, this kind of thing did happen regularly. The battle for succession, for royal succession, and particularly for influence, things like, you know, the Thomas of Becket being murdered and all these kinds of things. I mean, Diana was a very, very, figure who's right in the middle of the public eye. She was about to marry a Muslim, and she was actually far more popular amongst the public than Prince Charles. I mean, I don't know if I've told you this story before, but I met the pair of them when they were both, Diana was still alive in Salisbury, and there was a big concert which both of them were coming to. Prince Charles arrived in the helicopter, no Diana. Well, there was a sort of groan from the crowd, where's Diana, you know? And she waited about 15, 20 minutes after Prince Charles had got out of the helicopter. Then she stood in the doorway of the helicopter, and the whole crowd, Richie, erupted. Yeah. It's Diana, you know, pointed to her, and Charles was left sort of completely ignored by everyone, and you could see the bitterness on his face. You know, how come everyone loves her and not me? Well, it's because most people, if they didn't know directly, they knew via somebody that he'd been cheating on her. And that the people don't, you know, with Camilla, and maybe they didn't know even if it was specifically her. But their sympathies with her, because she came across as far more sincere. I mean, for example, we had a TV program last night with Prince Charles. I mean, he just comes across as sort of sycophantic and obsequious kind of character that is trying very, very hard to use his powerful position to persuade everyone that he's a lovely guy. Yeah. And it just doesn't work.
He idolized
them. It might work in America. It doesn't work here.
I have no doubt that Charles is abused by Mountbatten. Don't laugh, Tony. And I know you wouldn't have expected me to say that, because I know you expect better standards from me. But Mountbatten was a paedophile. Charles spent all his time with him. That whole family is screwed up. Tony Gosling is our guest. Gee, I mean, the amount of tweets coming in on this, we could be here all day talking about this. It's funny, Tony, you mentioned her grace and her poise and her goodness. She melted Republicans. I mean, I've heard stories of, you know, her meeting senior Republicans and melting. And a very quick story. Before Bono turned into an arsehole, years and years and years and years ago, when U2 had just released the Joshua Tree, before he was, before Bono was groomed by Bill Clinton and Bill Gates, she was at a gig. And Bono said to his dad, Bob Hewson, who was a retired postman from Dublin, and a Republican, Bob, and a hard man. And Bono said, do you want to meet the Princess of Wales? And Bob said, that's like asking me, do I want to meet Oliver Cromwell? He said, fuck off, you know. I don't want to have anything to do with any of them. But anyway, a few minutes later, Diana came over to Bob, Bono's dad, had a glass of champagne with him, and had a chat with him. And a few minutes later, Bob Hewson, this Dublin guy, this Republican, was like, unbelievable, lovely woman, lovely, oh, amazing woman, amazing. What a heart. So yeah, this is, these are mad times, this. So the Queen has apparently said anyway, yes, they can have their cake and eat it. So you would say that this is damage and imitation by the Crown.
I think also, let's not forget that some of her family actually warned Harry about Meghan before the marriage. I mean, these things often get forgotten about. They're saying, look, be careful of her. Yeah, because she's actually, we found her, quite a selfish individual. There is also the fact that many of the staff of Harry and Meghan have left. They've had a massive turnover of staff. I mean, there's all sorts of indications around that, you know, that it's... I mean, okay, so Harry is basically... What he's trying to do is break out of a cult. I think that's the best way to see it. It's just that she seems to be the person who's helping to manage that process and making it more painful, much more painful than it needs to be. I think they're going to be off to Canada. I think that's where they're heading. I don't think they'll be back.
Good stuff. Tony Gosling is our guest. Right, let's talk about Iran. Today, the UK's commercial and national media is obsessing about protests in Iran, anti-government protests. They're telling us that the people are uprising in Tehran because of the what they see as the cover-up, at least the initial cover-up, of the shooting down of the Ukrainian airliner. And also the people are uprising because economic conditions for people, times are pretty tough for people in Tehran. This falls, of course, this all comes after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the famous general, of course, and the man who many saw might be the successor to Ali Khamenei, or if not the successor to him, certainly the successor to, I should say, Hassan Rouhani. That would make more sense. What's happening here, Tony? Did we dodge a bullet here in terms of, did this nearly escalate to something serious, or is this just the beginning, and will 2020 see tensions get worse and eventually a war with Iran? What do you think?
Well, yes, I think it could easily have. I mean, everyone was talking about, I mean, apparently one of the big hashtags last Friday, Saturday was World War III. A lot of young people sharing this, you know, and saying, well, look, this is actually really reckless and really worrying. How would we like it if the chief of the general staff in London from the armed forces was assassinated by a drone from Iran? I mean, this is the way to look at these things. We always just think, well, we've just done this to these people. Well, what if they did it to us? And of course, it is an Archduke Ferdinand moment. You know, this is the sort of thing which can cause a massive, massive escalation, could easily have done. I think I was just reading the weekend, the Saker's blog. He's a guy I've interviewed a couple of times. He's a former military advisor to the United Nations who was telling them things they didn't want to hear. So he got the sack. He now lives in Florida. I think he's originally a Russian guy. But he said, I think, very, very importantly, look, this is a masterful move by Iran. The first time they've really stood up to what he calls the Anglo-Zionist Empire, and they've done it very successfully. In other words, what they did is they made a reprisal against these US air bases, which I thought was, and in fact, humorous even, because this is exactly the air base that Trump had been saying a couple of days before, that, well, if the Iranians want us to leave, then they're going to have to pay us for this airbase that we built. And, of course, the Iranians have now destroyed that airbase, so there's nothing to pay for anymore. So there's a sort of irony in all of that, which I don't think is lost in the Middle East, but it's certainly lost on the Western media. Nobody's picked up on that at all. So the assassination, well, look, there is also another aspect to this. Okay, so lots not to talk about, but Saturday afternoon, there were these protests in Tehran and protests in London. There was no coverage whatsoever on the BBC radio or on the television. I didn't see all the channels, but of the London protests. Big protest at the BBC, over 1,000 people, then marching to Trafalgar Square, speeches by Corbyn, et cetera, not covered at all. And yet they are covering, of course, the roughly the same size, in fact, demonstration in Tehran. They're covering it absolutely nine to five on Saturday evening. So it's really interesting to see that a protest outside the BBC is not noticed by the BBC, but an equivalent demonstration in Tehran is. So it's very, very clear and obvious, you know, that there's an enormous bias in this coverage. And I think this is always what they hope when they do this, that they won't notice what we're not being told. Yeah. And what we're not being told is that there's an enormous strength of feeling in the UK against this move by Trump and by the deep state in the US to assassinate Soleimani. But look, the most important thing I think in much of this coverage, which hasn't really been come out in the West here at all, is the reasons behind it and the background to it. And particularly the idea which has been circulating all over the Middle East, in Iraq, and I suppose it's because it's in a different language, maybe, that the Western press doesn't know it's happening. I don't know if they've got any translators or they can use Google Translate or whatever. But anyway, it's because the Iraqis have said that in September, the Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki went over to China to do a deal with President Xi to help build infrastructure in Iraq, because the Americans have been very, very slow, and also that they're insisting on massive amounts of oil revenue going out as well. So, in other words, we'll rebuild your infrastructure, but you've got to give us your oil. And the Chinese were saying, well, we'll just do a deal for the infrastructure. And so the Iraqis wanted the Chinese deal.
Yeah.
But apparently in September, just a day or so after the Prime Minister got back to Iraq, he was phoned by Trump. And this is what was talked about in the Iraqi parliament last weekend, not this weekend, last weekend, where the Prime Minister told the MPs that he'd had this phone conversation with Trump, where Trump threatened to cause demonstrations in Baghdad and also threatened to kill him and his defense minister if he signed this deal with China.
No way.
And he is stealing it out, basically. He's saying, no, you're not going to do that. We're going to do this deal with China. And so that's a report which I referenced on my show on Friday at thisweek.org.uk. And this is just a basic bit of translation from the Iraqi language and from the Iraqi news into the UK. But that doesn't seem to have
great work,
been talked about at all. But the main thing...
Hey, is, listen, okay, before we thing, go on, hang on. That's great work, yeah, by the way. I didn't know that. Thanks for that. That's really important to know that. That Chinese discussion about building infrastructure in Iraq, and what that means to the states, the threats made by Trump, that's very, very good. Before you go on that train of thought, though, what a catastrophe in terms of public relations. You were 100% right when you said there was a deep resentment in this country, and no doubt in Ireland, and in mainland Europe, about the assassination of Soleimani. The Iranians had the moral high ground. What a screw-up, Tony, shooting down that Ukrainian airliner. And then not to admit immediately that they did it. That was dreadful, wasn't it? What do you think?
Well, it is. Okay, so, yes, I would suggest what probably happened is you've got a whole sort of confusion going on within the Iranian military, where they don't want to admit what they've done. You know, yeah, it might be just as a similar sort of thing might well happen over here. I mean, we didn't know for several days what was behind that shoot down of the aircraft. And we had to speculate on Friday. It may have been all sorts of things. And what we did is we basically looked at all the options, including the fact that the Iranians had shot it down. So, you know, yes, but it's a screw up. But in a way, I think most people in the world will view it in the light which I do, which is, well, if the Americans had not escalated tensions to put the Iranian forces on this hair trigger in this way, this probably would never have happened. And the ultimate responsibility really, really lies with the person that set the whole, all of the militaries on edge in the first place, ready for a potential massive war. And the reason that didn't happen, let's make it clear. This is, I got this from the Saker and various, well, it's actually, I did it live on Press TV on the Iranian channel, actually on, I think it was Thursday or Wednesday evening, was that the Iranians had threatened, and this was put out through the Tehran Bureau of NBC through the journalist from NBC in Tehran, the American network, that if the Americans struck back after the attack on the air bases, that the Iranians would destroy Dubai and Haifa in Israel. So Dubai in the UAE and Haifa in Israel would be the subject of a massive ballistic missile attack from Iran. And so that what they've done is they've done a fairly low-level attack on these American air bases, which is their primary objective, is to get the Americans out of the Middle East, and it should be the primary objective of peace campaigners right across the world. But the secondary thing that they're saying is, well, we recognize that there are powerful forces in Dubai and in Israel that are also aiding this whole process, and we're going to hit them if you strike back against us. So it was quite a quite wise move by the Iranians not to target human beings, not to target individuals. But of course, you know, the pulling down of the air, or the shooting down of the airliner, I think most people can understand, well, that's a mistake that happens. And perhaps, the aviation authorities should have been thinking that and should not have been allowing civilian airliners to fly around at such a moment of high tension.
Maybe. Yeah, all right. I mean, I agree with you in terms of, what you said about everything you said about the Soleimani assassination. Fascinated by the China angle. We'll definitely pursue that in the coming days. I want to ask you, Tony Gosling is our guest, by the way, thisweek.org.uk. If you haven't checked out Tony's program, The Politics Show, do check it out. Bilderberg.org as well, it's a terrific site as well. Let me just... A million tweets came in there, Tony. I don't like ignoring them on this particular issue as well. Let's go down here. I wanted to ask you, after the publication of the Chilcot report, and in the immediate days after the publication of Chilcot, the media, you'll remember this well, vividly you'll remember this, the broadsheet media, particularly in this country, apologised for its conduct in the run-up to the Iraq War. It did. The Guardian, The Independent, I know there was something as well in The Times about not giving... You know, about regretting not holding Blair and his government to holding their feet to the fire in the way they should have done. They promised they wouldn't do it again. They're a lying share of bastards, aren't they, Tony?
They're all absolutely lying.
Exactly the same thing, right?
One of the most fascinating comparisons with the Soleimani assassination is looking at the comparison to the entrapment by the American ambassador to Iraq, April Glasby, back in 1989-1990, where she said to Saddam Hussein, well, it's okay, you can go into Kuwait. Officially, the US has no position on this. Obviously, the Kuwaitis are stealing your oil from under the ground. They had a load of drilling rigs along the border, you know, and this was seen as, and so April Glasby, the US ambassador, said to Saddam Hussein, it's okay, you can go in and attack. And in fact, you can take over Kuwait. We don't have a position on it. Go for it. And that, of course, was entrapment, because as soon as they did go for it, the Americans went absolutely nuts on the world stage, at the Security Council, the UN, and the first Gulf War started. So there's a similar thing actually going on last week with the Soleimani assassination, because it's become quite clear now through the Lebanese press, the Syrian press, the sort of press that we don't get in London or Washington, that that Soleimani was over in Baghdad on a peace mission, which was actually an initiative of the US, would you believe? So the US was suggesting that the Saudis should be talking to the Iranians. And that this could have potentially, although there maybe the US arms companies didn't want this, but they could be negotiating an end to the war in Yemen, for example, potentially to the forces in Libya, and several Middle East conflicts could have been potentially diffused by this. Now, looking back on it now, seeing Soleimani assassinated, it does look as if the Americans had no intention of this actually taking place. It was simply a ruse to get Soleimani to Baghdad, to get him into a place where potentially he wasn't. He was going to be exposed. He thought he was going to be doing something good. and that we were going to be seeing a diffusion of tension in the Middle East. But that's quite clear. The evidence is quite clear about that. That's what they're saying over in that part of the world, is Soleimani was over here to broker a peace deal suggested by the Americans with the Saudis. And that is exactly the sort of thing that the American diplomats were doing to start the first Gulf War. So entrapment. I would suggest never believe ever any American diplomat again, because these people simply can be not interested in peace. I mean, I think you have to be just suspicious. If they're interested in peace, that means that they're interested in not selling weapons. That's all they seem to really care about, making money for the shareholders of the arms companies, Richie. And when it comes to peace, they're not interested.
No, they're not. It was, you know, speaking of one or two journalists doing their jobs, it was nice to see Mike Pompeo, the US Secretary of State, looking a bit uncomfortable when he was briefing from the White House last week, and one or two of the old hacks, tired old hacks, some of them, just had enough of his bullshit and said, hang on a second, you told us that Soleimani was involved in things, in plots that were about ready to go. Now you're rolling back on that and you're saying that, you know, that he was involved in stuff. You're not being very specific, and it was very good to see that.
Okay. I mean, what they were saying, what Pompeo and others actually said, not straight away, but in the days after the assassination, was Soleimani was plotting to blow up the US embassy.
Yeah.
And of course, by the way, I don't know if you know, but after the week after Christmas, when there were the attacks on the embassy itself, it was under siege, although no one was killed or anything, the ambassador apparently left Baghdad. So, you know, what they're saying is, I think the main purpose of this is because this is the legal reason which is needed under the international law to do an assassination like this, is if you can prove that someone is about to do an imminent attack, even though this is legally a bit dodgy, someone has actually had to do an attack on your country. So what they're saying is, well, we believe he was about to do an attack on our embassy, which is pretty much part of our country in Iraq. So this is extremely flaky legal ground they're on, but they think that they can get away with it by patting each other on the back with the lawyers in Washington saying, oh, this is a legal reason why this assassination is legal. Of course, it wasn't. It was a war crime. And the actual evidence for their war crime doesn't stand up to any kind of test, because he clearly wasn't going to destroy the US embassy, what with having no ambassador there anyway. So this is all just made up by Pompeo, etc. No wonder he was looking a bit nervous.
Pack of lies. Hey, listen, we're about out of time, so I want to ask you a favour. The timeline that you posted on politicsthisweek.wordpress.com, thisweek.org.uk links there as well, the Martin Bormann Nazi Gold timeline, is some brilliant read, Tony. I have to congratulate you. It's absolutely brilliant. I've just posted.
Well, I'm still putting the bits of the jigsaw
You're
together.
You're still putting
actually.
It together.
Still finding little bits, you know, week by week, finding other little bits of that jigsaw, yeah.
It's brilliant, mate. So what I suggest is, in a couple of weeks' time, at your pleasure, at your leisure, at your convenience, we'll do a second hour of the programme, because it's going to take a bit of time, this, rather than you come on and do a news roundup with me. When it suits you, just after six, we'll go through this and we'll have a right good chat about it, because not only is it hugely fascinating, it's entertaining as well. It shouldn't be maybe entertaining, but it is. But it's also very educational and important.
Well, it is, and I think it explains a hell of a lot. There's a couple of things which, if I've just got a minute, I can say, which I've come across over the last week.
Go on, you've got a minute.
First of all, the reasons why we haven't seen Israel pursuing Nazi war criminals, of course, right from the word go, when the Israeli state was founded in 1948. One of the reasons was because pro-Nazi Nelson Rockefeller agreed with David Ben-Gurion in 1948, just a few days before the vote at the UN to recognize Israel, that he would deliver the Latin American countries' votes pro the partition of Palestine for the new Israeli state, but only if David Ben-Gurion and the Israelis agreed and promised never to pursue Nazi war criminals in South America, or ones being controlled by the Dulles brothers and those in the US intelligence network. So that's one of the main reasons why we never saw the Israelis actually pursuing these Nazi war criminals. The other one is one of the things I discovered was that the shipment of uranium, enriched uranium from the Nazis and this submarine U-234, which was sent out right at the very end of the war. Now, that was sent to Japan because, obviously, at the end of the war, the Nazis wanted the Japanese to have this enriched uranium, potentially for a weapon. Anyway, it was just the day after Martin Bormann arrived in London. He was brought over there by British commandos and by Desmond Morton, Churchill's private secretary. After Bormann arrived in the UK, the two Japanese officers on board that submarine were shot, and the submarine changed course, and literally a day after that, the enriched uranium was handed over to the Americans, Richie, half a ton of it, actually, and that went straight to the Manhattan Project. So it looks as if most of the enriched uranium used in the Trinity test and the two live bombs on Japan was actually produced by the Nazis and handed over in that way. So, and Bormann played a big part in making sure it went to the Americans and not the Japs.
Let's get into that real soon, mate. You pick the time and we'll do it, because our listeners are going to love it. It's hugely important. It's unknown history. It's what we call hidden history, and it's great work. I really enjoyed reading that. Thisweek.org.uk, the politics show live from Bristol weekly on BCFM. You can't miss it, folks. I meant it when I said it earlier on. The last bastion of real journalism left in the UK on local radio. I'm telling you, there's nothing like it. Tony, thanks for coming on.
The funny thing is, BBC used to do a programme which looked at all these things called Time Watch.
They did,
and that stopped around about 93, 94.
Was it 93?
They haven't done anything decent ever since. I mean, that's when it finished, yeah.
But anyway,
I'm happy to do a thing with you pretty much any evening over the next week or so. That's absolutely fine. A couple of weeks, Richie, no problem.
Fantastic. On that exclusively, Tony. Thanks, mate. Love having you on. You know that. Speak again real soon. And thanks for your help today. The brilliant Tony Gosling. Cheers, mate. The great Tony Gosling, live on the Richie Allen Radio Show for Monday 13th, it is. That's the 13th of January 2020.